organisers, maybe in particular, and this is going to be, I can see, a terrific conference, and I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to talk in these focuses. If you did say parallel sessions, most conferences are parallel sessions, well, everyone is there. Alright, so the image interpretation of the user's manual, like most user's manuals, it's maybe some faults and so forth, but you can get it online. Whoops, I'll go back. There it is, you see. So that's the other conference, and that'll probably be even more confusing. User's manuals online, not much good anyway. So now what I want to do in this talk is really give an overview of the issues and the structure of the various arguments that I think we're going to see presented over the next 4 days. They're moderately complex, which is why I think it's worth spending some time in surveying the field in advance. Of course, the danger with that is that everything's presented at a rather high level of abstraction, and you're not getting the nuts and bolts of the arguments. So forgive me if you get a bit of a sense of that, but I hope it's made up for in terms of seeing where the various bits of the jigsaw puzzle fit together. So first point, of course, is, well, why many worlds? So obviously, to solve the measurement problem, and this isn't a very historically accurate way of putting it, of course, it suggests that the theory, you know, we were just given the unitary equations or something, and then, my gosh, what are we going to do with these? That's, of course, not how the history went. The history went that the equations were discovered with a rough and ready interpretation, works in certain areas, not in others, eventually elaborated into the measurement postulates. Expand the state in a given basis, depending on what is measured. So the design of the experiment, its purpose, determines the basis that you use. And then one supposes that the modulus square of the coefficients gives you the probability of a relevant outcome. And in certain circumstances, it had better be the case that the state itself is modified in that way and collapses to one of those in the case of repeatable experiments. That's the projection postulate. Okay, now I won't go over what's unsatisfactory about the measurement postulates and this conventional method for applying the theory. I will just give criteria that I think one would demand of any fundamental physical theory. Not everybody will demand this, but realists do. I guess it's just a matter of what one thinks the whole enterprise of physics is about. So the theory is to apply universally, fundamental theory is to apply universally, without any special mention of the observer or measurement. Those are just physical systems among others. Of course, extremely central vis-a-vis epistemological questions. But as goes, you know, what is physical? Not privileged, just very complex. And this last point, without any special interpretative assumptions or additional equations. That's what separates off the Everett interpretation from its rivals, the two principal ones being dynamical collapse theories and hidden variable deterministic theories, GRW and pilot wave being the best known. They modify the equations or they add new equations. And the problem with doing that, of course, is we don't have evidence preferring one over the other in the non-relativistic realm, and those modified theories don't properly exist in the relativistic case. Now, the reason for no special interpretative assumptions is rather specific to Everett. I don't think that would apply in general. Why not make special interpretive assumptions? But Everett, because it's Everett, really had better work using fairly orthodox standard presuppositions, methodology, and so forth. It had better be conservative because it's so fantastic. I mean, how are you going to argue with someone on the basis of special assumptions in favor of a fantastical view? The response will be, well, I just don't buy into these special assumptions. But if the claim is, look, quantum mechanics forces this or naturally leads to this perspective on what is reality, this branching universe, without any special assumptions, then I think the thing becomes entirely more compelling. Okay, so the parallel I want to draw first is with Galileo, and this is in terms of trying to get over what Everett himself did. It is, after all, 50 years since his paper, we should say something about it. He was confronting problems to do with the Copernican theory, specifically, why don't we see the Earth move? And the typical objections, well, if the Earth moved, there would be a great wind. And if the Earth moved, falling bodies would fall behind in the direction of its motion. There was a thing about masts on ships, and you drop something on the top of the mast, and so on and so forth. So the response that Galileo made is, well, look, the Earth and everything on its surface and its atmosphere are subject to the same motion, and only relative motions are observable. Okay. And of course, that needed quite a substantial bit more, both of physics and more articulation in different contexts. The physics side, it needed the principle of inertia. He had the wrong principle. He thought everything moved naturally in circles. So Descartes, I think, was the first to say, no, no, straight line motion. And it needed Newton to give some dynamical content to both the natural motions and departures from it. And there's a similar development, I think, with Everett. Okay, so the obvious problem, if you're going to say that the unitary equations are hold with unrestricted validity, is, well, why don't we see superpositions? If there are any superpositions, we would all turn into blancmange. If there are any superpositions, there would be no meaning to probability. Okay, to which the answer was, well, when macroscopic superpositions arise, everything enters into the superposition, including the apparatus and the environment, and only correlations are observable. Okay. Well, I think this is a fairly trivial observation that I'm making, this comparison, but I did think it was mine. Only last night I discovered from our resident historian, Peter Byrne, that actually this was the very argument that Everett used in discussions with DeWitt, which would have, I guess, been in the early 60s, and which DeWitt found enormously compelling, you know, this very comparison. So I suppose I'm pleased about that. Anyway.
Actually, I'm not sure.
Peter?
There's a footnote in his Redmond
paper. Yes.
Which makes the connection explicit.
Yeah.
Oh. And the way
that we get in there?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, no.
You see, I haven't read this paper.
It's not on the archives.
I don't know where my local library is. So now, let me just go with just the formal details. So this is a simplified model, everybody knows it. You've got the environment, you've got the measuring apparatus, the rate state, the electron spin. I've written this product state, which is wildly unlisted.
Behind unitary evolution. Unitary evolution drives the measuring apparatus to record spin up. The electron remains in spin up, and there's some impact on the environment here, some coupling between the apparatus and the environment. We don't worry about that too much. So what happens in the case of a superposition? And the answer is, well, you get a superposition of these two terms. Actually, I don't have a pointer. Do I? Oh, this is the pointer, of course. Forgetting what country I was in. So you have a superposition of the two terms. And
it's not always true. In Britain, we use French less. Okay, and if you have two such particles prepared in initial superposition states, then you end up with four terms in the superposition. And you get
some statistical structure appearing as well. The measurement device displays the record of outcomes and so forth. Now, let me just give a graphical representation of this. The width of the lines is supposed to give you a representation of the amplitude squared, the weight, the amplitude squared. This sort of representation, put it back into the context of the measurement problem, what's on offer? I mean, the response to why many worlds and so forth is, this is what is really going on. We are one term within the superposition. And if you've got that, then I don't really think there's a problem with probability. I mean, one doesn't know which world is one's own. One's one of these things. This is fairly standard. It doesn't matter that the other worlds exist or not. That's relevant to the question, well, which world is mine? And I need some sort of a probability measure over these worlds. And using that, I can then conditionalize in the standard way and have well-grounded expectations and so on and so forth. In a certain sense, the thing is unproblematic if you've only got this representation. And I think a lot of physicists who were well disposed towards the Everett interpretation more or less took it as that. But the problem being, well, what? What is the basis? You know, what choice of superposition? And that remained the one and only, in the minds of many physicists, I think, those favorable to it anyway, the one and only problem. But actually, I think it's really rather an insuperable problem. It's an insuperable one if your guideline is the conventional method, the conventional measurement postulates, because it really is an orthonormal basis that you're looking at or looking to find. And how on earth are you going to do that? What orthonormal basis is going to be privileged? Okay. Now, things, though, take a slightly different turn if you do the natural move, which is to amalgamate the initial segments of these worlds, which are in common. After all, initially, you've just got, you know, I started off with a product state, which developed into the superposition. And once you do that, then the thing looks really rather problematic from a different point of view. The whole issue of what is probability becomes much more problematic. Now, I think that's the right thing to do. Also, though, the right thing to do is really get rid of those measurement postulates because they're, I think, sending the wrong signals. This is much more from a realistic point of view, and now I'm begging questions as to how one arrives at this sort of branching structure. Of course, it's through decoherence theory. But this is the sort of thing that one is really going to arrive at, and the right questions to ask is, well, why think there is a branching structure at all? Don't just help yourself to it because you help yourself to the idea of an orthonormal basis. Why I think it's significant. One can represent a force, a vector, as a parallelogram law of vectors. You know, you can do it in infinitely many different ways. Are all of those infinite varieties of vectors that sum to give you the one you had originally, are they all there? That seems nonsense. Why on earth think that they're all there? And why think there are probabilities in the theory at all? And after all, the entire wave function is unitary. Evolution is deterministic. Why think there's any place for probability at all? Okay. So these two questions, if you like, ontology, probability, that's what the rest of my talk is going to be about. So I'm going to go into the ways in which various arguments have been presented to address, and there's two sorts of issues. One is, let's call it the incoherence problem. The other, the quantitative problem. The incoherence problem is really saying, there's something just unintelligible about this, both on the ontology side and on the probability side. And a lot of people made that point, mostly more on the probability side, I think, but recently, and I think we saw that in the Oxford conference, on the ontology side as well. There's just some sort of conceptual gap here, something really utterly unexplained, unreasonable incoherence. Okay, now the quantitative problem is rather, okay, you've got some sort of a branching structure, or you know roughly what to say about ontology, but precisely what you say, what are the details? And in the case of probability, suppose it's coherent, intelligible, that probability makes sense in this unitary deterministic branching structure. It makes sense, but still the issue is, well then, what are the precise probabilities? So that's the quantitative problem as opposed to the incoherence problem. And both of them have to be addressed. It's no good getting out an account of quantum mechanics in which you make sense of ontology, you make sense of some notion of uncertainty, but there's absolutely no reason whatsoever why those probabilities should be the Born rule probabilities. Okay, so this would be a failure, complete failure of the approach if that were the case. So we've got to answer both of these sorts of problems. Okay, let me just say a word about the ontology problem. I'm going to come back to that at the end of the talk. But provisionally, I just want to point out, well, there is something immediately worrying about branching, something incoherent, which is, look, I mean, after all, we're talking about the universe. It includes people. So here's somebody. And a little bit later, there's two people. So what on earth is this relationship supposed to be? How is one to understand it? And I think if the Everett interpretation uniquely brought up this problem, and this problem just had never occurred to anyone, had never arisen before, I think it would already be a damning problem, not necessarily fatal to the approach, but it would be, look, here's an interpretative strategy that brings with it an extraordinary, remarkable, entirely novel problem. I think that would be a problem. But it's not a novel problem. It's one that philosophers have been bothering about since ancient philosophy, I guess over a very enormously long period of time, people have worried about this, and indeed the problem arises with any materialistic theory of the self. Okay, so this is something rather typical, I think, of the Everett interpretation, that it has extraordinary conceptual problems, but they are familiar conceptual problems, strangely. I mean, you know, one wouldn't think that, but they are... All would be too strong, but the great majority, I think, are familiar, both in the issue of ontology and in the case of probability. They're just somehow more in your face. Okay, so now, the incoherence problem, there is a response, and the response is, look, in the face of branching, that's exactly a basis on which to be uncertain. And I'm going to come back to how that might go in a minute. All right, now, probability. For the next 20 minutes or so, I'll talk only about probability. and I'm going to, as it were, assume the ontology problem is solved. We know the structure of the universal state. We've got this branching structure. And that includes the amplitude squared, the weights. Okay, and when I say that the ontology problem is solved, I don't mean by that the point about personal fission is solved. Let's just assimilate that to the probability problem. Okay, now there's two ways to look at it, this situation of fission. Either uncertainty is intelligible, what I was just suggesting, and that's a point of view that I have defended in print, so I guess I'm stuck with it. the other is that, no, it's not intelligible, or it's not intelligible enough to be a solid enough foundation, if you like, to derive probabilities or give a decent analysis of probability. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we've just got incoherence. We still have to deal with multiplicities in the future. We're not bringing free will immediately anyway into the equation. We suppose it's up to us what set of multiplicities we arrange for ourselves, and we may have different preferences for those multiplicities. We just care more or less about one multiplicity rather than another, one branching structure rather than another. So call that caring, degree of caring, call it caring measure. This is Hilary Greaves' work. I mean, I must say, pretty well everything I'm going to say is very substantially work of David Wallace, Hilary Greaves, and Wayne Myhrvold. So I'm setting up and giving background to all of their talks. So caring measure, call it caring measure if you like. On the quantitative problem, now there's two ways of breaking this down, and two further bits of terminology, again due to Hilary Greaves, practical problem, epistemic problem. So, and this may seem a bit curious, because in both cases one's dealing with degrees of belief. Okay. So the key issue is what are one's degrees of belief, subjective probabilities, if that notion makes sense, caring measure, if that's all that we legitimately have available. And the issue is how to arrive at those degrees of care, subjective probabilities, and so forth. But there's two ways that have developed in literature as to how to arrive at those things. One way is, well, suppose you know everything there is to know. You've got the ontology in totality. You've got the God's eye view. You know everything. What then? Okay. And there's an argument that says, well, one can arrive on the basis of that ontology and rather weak actions of decision theory. A rational agent subject to those axioms will arrive at degrees of belief equal to the branch weights. Okay, a very remarkable result due to David Deutsch and David Wallace. So, and that solves the practical problem. I think Hilary's reasons for calling it the practical problem, the picture was this. Look, you know the furniture of the universe. How do you negotiate it? You know, practically, how do you get around? Right. So that's one sort of thing. Now, the other question, though, is, well, look, how do you arrive at the theory in the first place? It may be that if you believe Everett to be true, I mean, you may not know the actual structure of the universe, the wave function of the universe, but you've got some, you know, scientific conjecture as to what it is. You believe that to be the case, how to act, answer, subjective degrees of belief, equal weights, fine. But what if you don't believe the Everett theory to be true? How on earth are you to arrive at such a theory? How are you to incrementally confirm it? Okay, and this is really to say, what's your confirmation theory? What inductive process have you have available, which is going to also involve degrees of belief. It's also going to involve questions of credence, caring measure, if you like, in terms of evaluating the relation of one theory to another, which is better confirmed. Okay, so call that the epistemic problem, and you really have to solve both, actually. I mean, it's no good just solving this one, because how on earth are you going to learn about the ontology? I mean, you've got to learn about the ontology. The thing is, if you do solve it, if you do solve this one, it's not going to be too hard to solve that. And let me just go through that detail, okay? Another point to make is that if you've got the epistemic problem solved, well, of course, then you've learnt that the theory is better than its rivals. You're also discovering what the theory says. You're learning about the ontology, right? And because issues of evidence, confirmation of theory, is so closely allied to what it's rational to believe, you've solved the practical problem as well. Okay. So in many ways, the epistemic problem is the fundamental one. Okay. But I'm going to start off with the view that actually branching, it is right and proper to be uncertain in the face of branching. Okay. And if that's the case, chances make sense. They're not what we thought they were, but then not many things are, if you think about it. I mean, thoughts aren't what we thought they were. They're brain processes, for heaven's sake. I mean, neural processes. Whoever thought that's what a thought was? And lots of things aren't what we thought. Their colors aren't what we thought they were. Right? Colors, you know, relative spectral reflectances of surfaces, electromagnetic structure, wavelengths. You know, that doesn't seem like color at all. So I think it's actually a very general situation in science, and the great glory of science, frankly, that we find that things aren't what we thought they were. Okay, so chances turn out to be branches. See, even rhymes. Okay, now, why think that branching is appropriate to think of uncertainty? Well, here's a simple answer. I expect what I remember, and I expect more of the same. And of course, what I remember, this isn't the first time I'm about to branch. I've been branching forever. Everything that I remember in the past has been a branching event or any outcome of a branching event. I just expect more of the same. It's a serial order. Okay. So very simple-minded. And it's actually rather a Humean account of uncertainty. It's rather like the account of induction. Philosophers among you will know what I mean. Hume's argument for induction. It's not cognitive. okay. All right. Another sort of tack is, well, what do words like uncertainty and so forth mean anyway, as ordinarily used? And there's very general questions about this in philosophy of language. And people have very different views, of course, philosophy, everybody always has different views, but I think a fairly dominant view, and certainly one that I ascribe to, and I recommend to you, is that the meanings of words are determined by use or nothing. Okay, words don't have meanings that are not determined by use. I'm talking about ordinary usages of words. I'm not talking about mathematical theorems and words that can occur in there. Okay? I'm talking about ordinary usages of words. If they're not determined by use, if they're not manifested in use, if they're not manifested in overt linguistic behavior, then they're unlearnable. Okay? I mean, you may have private meanings going around in your head if you want, but they're not relevant. Okay? What's relevant is how they get keyed to public usage. So that's a general point of view, right? And it's an important one, rather. And I want to bring it up in the question of the temporal issue. Now, this was what was up a while ago. It can't be right anymore, can it? Okay. So what's on earth going on? And this is something that most physicists don't think about much, but some do. Weyl is one who did. And this is what he had to say about it. The world is, it does not happen. Only to the gaze of consciousness crawling up the lifeline of your body does it fleetingly come to life. Okay. Well, that's a terrible thing to say. I mean, look, you know, so your consciousness, you see, it's not there anymore, it's there, but what on earth? So what happened here? All that stuff I was telling you, there was nobody conscious to hear about it. And I presumably wasn't conscious when I was saying it either. So there's something really wrong with this way of understanding four-dimensionalism. And the right way, surely, is to say, well, consciousness is everywhere. Well, if somebody's asleep, you know, then wake up. Please wake up. But otherwise, consciousness is everywhere. Now, what do you say in the face of this? And what I've got in mind, of course, is the block universe. And here's something that metaphysicians say about the block universe. Okay, and look, metaphysics, what is metaphysics as goes physics? Physics I take to be a physical theory as written down in physical textbooks. And four-dimensionalism, I think, is unremarkable in that context. Okay, we talk about a four-dimensional manifold, a four-dimensional affine space, Newtonian gravity, four-dimensional manifold, Riemannian, general relativity. That's what's in the textbooks. That's not in contention. Metaphysics, when metaphysicians, when they talk about four-dimensionalism, aren't quarreling with what's written in the physics textbooks. They're quarreling about something else. And they're quarreling with things like, words like change, becoming, identity, right? The now, present, the present. They're talking about stuff like that. And I take it to be this is what metaphysics is about. And now, this is not a view popular among metaphysicians. Metaphysicians think that they are finding out what ultimate reality is. And they're doing it, strangely and interestingly, without ever doing any experiments. They haven't made much progress in a very long time, but this doesn't seem to bother them. for reasons that I don't quite understand. Anyway, so this is the sort of things that they say in four-dimensionalism. Well, there is no change. Time does not flow. There is no becoming. And there is no free will. That possibly is also something they say. So they'll say lots of things like that. And then they can even, if they're feeling especially stroppy, say to the physicist, look, you've got to rewrite your textbooks because I see you've got this thing, four-dimensionalism, in your textbooks, and that's no good. So you've got to find a different theory. Right? Now, that may seem silly, but the claim is that this is exactly what's been going on with the Everett interpretation. Right, so. Oh, before I go on to the Everett interpretation, let me just say what's the right thing to say about four-dimensionalism. The right thing is to say that change resides in the relations among events throughout your lifetime. Okay. And of course, then I have to say something about the flow of time is, dot, 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 becoming is, free will is. I have to say things about that. But it's philosophical work. But it's not getting at fundamental truth. That's the claim. It's getting at truth conditions for ordinary usage of terms. Yes, sir.
To use this on Everett, is it the job of a metaphysician to endorse four-dimensionalism as opposed to presentism, and are you doing that?
Metaphysicians do indeed do that, and that's a part of the issue of. They can do it two ways. They can do it in terms of the deflationary way that I'm doing it, but most of them don't do it in the deflationary way. Most of them do it in the way of, this is true reality, and the physicists just have got various formal techniques that may or may not involve four-dimensional representations, but that's not what true reality is. True reality, and this would be a certain sort of solution, a certain metaphysical point of view, is the present. Okay. And that may or may not lead to revision of physical theories. So let me go now to the branching universe case, and again, there's a similar sort of response. There is no probability. It's deterministic. You know, four-dimensional case, it's all laid out there, so there's no change. There's no such thing as uncertainty. There's nothing about which to be ignorant, and so forth. And then in the face of that, one can say, look, in the physics books, it's written down unitary equations of quantum mechanics. Well, that's just all wrong. You've got to change those equations. And a lot of people in this room say that. Okay? So this gets rather personal. And the way to change the equations is by adding to them pilot wave or GRW, dynamical state reduction, or Nelsonian stochastic dynamics, or some hitherto unknown whatever. You know, we've got to change the equation. And that's a very widespread view in the foundations community. Not, I think, in the physics community, than the more mainstream physics community. Okay. So the alternative thing to say is probabilities are relative weights of branches, and one's got to say something about uncertainty, something about ignorance, and so forth. Now, if there was nothing at all to say here, if I rack my brains and I can't come up with a damn thing, then I think I'm in trouble. But what I don't have to do is come up with some deep substantive truth about what
what the self is, what the I is, what persons are. I don't have to do that. I have to give truth conditions for ordinary usage of sentences. Okay, and broadly speaking, it's going to go along the lines of what I'm uncertain about is which history is mine, notwithstanding the fact that there is genuine branching here. We don't just have a series of disconnected worlds. I'm in one of them, I don't know what it is. They're connected worlds in this way. It is a branching structure. But the point is this. Here's a view on what one is. One is a continuance, cradle to grave. I don't know what that continuum is. I don't know which continuum I am. I know what I am up to the present moment. I don't know anything beyond it. Okay, now that's a story, and there's a lot more to say about that, but I'm not going to say it now. I'm going to hurry on. Okay. Supposing the incoherence problem is soluble in that way, what happens then? Well, a lot of things happen. One of them is the route to discovering the Everett interpretation of quantum mechanics, or Everettian quantum mechanics, the route to it becomes actually rather standard, it seems to me. There's just nothing very problematic about it. If branches are chances, well, here we are, you know, we're just learning what those chances are, looking at statistical evidence, in just the way we standardly do. And questions of degrees of subjective belief and how they relate to these objective chances are dealt with in exactly the same way as they are in any other theory, because we are being conservative about this notion of chance. Okay, and if we've got that, we discover what the structure of the theory is in the normal manner of empirical investigation. This gives us the ontology, of course, but also it solves the practical problem. We've got the epistemic problem. It's reasonable to believe this theory to be confirmed better than some other theory, and so on and so forth. And that connects through in reasonable ways to what a rational agent should do. And the answer is, of course, tune subjective degrees of belief to branch weights. Okay, but look, here's a more remarkable argument. And this truly is, I think, unprecedented. I mean, the one I just gave is just business as usual, but this argument is remarkable. I don't think there's been anything like it in philosophy. I mean, philosophers do speculate about all sorts of crazy theories, and nobody's ever come up with an argument like this before. And it solves problems in the foundations of probability theory that have never been solved. You know, really, from the philosophical point of view, really intractable problems solved in this way. So in a way, even if the Everett interpretation falls apart, or is disconfirmed, you know, quantum mechanics, whatever, it's suddenly disconfirmed. I think this argument in connection with this theory will be a philosophical milestone if it stands up. Does it stand up? First of all, let me give you an idea of what it is. It goes like this. Introduce axioms of rationality to be satisfied in the rankings of preferences of a rational actor among quantum games in accordance with his utilities. Okay? And a nice set of axioms, the Savage axioms, will be discussed, I think, by Hilary or Wayne. When are they talking? On Sunday. Okay. Prove there exists an essentially unique utility function and probability distribution over outcomes of games under which the preferences of the actor are the same as those which maximize the expected utilities. Now, that's a bit of a mouthful. And it's something a bit peculiar about it. It's almost as though a rational actor will just, as it were, sleepwalk his way into assigning probabilities, subjective degrees of belief. The point is, they have to rank order in some way or another if they obey these axioms of rationality. And of course, you've got to scrutinize those axioms, see exactly what they say. You know, just how plausible, how compelling are they? But anyway, granted that they are actually rather compelling and very simple, and uncontentious, may I say, in any other circumstance, any other context, then you have this proof, you know, that the actor just is acting as though maximizing expected utilities. Now, that's not really the remarkable point about this. That's actually rather standard. That's an old result. The remarkable thing is this. The probability measure that you arrive at, the subjective degrees of belief, is independent of the agent's utility function, is uniquely the Born rule. It has to be the Born rule if it agrees with the Born rule in the case of equally weighted branches. Okay. So we call that the equivalence rule. I think in the literature it's called the equivalence principle, but there's an obvious other principle called the equivalence principle. So let's call it the equivalence rule, if I may. So this is the Deutsch-Wallis representation theorem, and it's rather remarkable. Strangely, David doesn't think it's very remarkable, but I do. And look, there's something stronger the equivalence rule itself is well motivated. Okay, and perhaps that's the thing that's truly remarkable, that one can argue for the equivalence rule as something like a rationality principle. So what we've got is, of course, you need to know what those equal weights are, so you need the ontology. Right? We're not talking about how you could go around discovering the Everettian quantum mechanics to be true. So given the ontology, and of course, given the equivalence rule, as yet I haven't given arguments for it, the practical problem is solved. Okay, so that's the really, I think, the remarkable result, and the arguments for the equivalence rule are remarkable too. David, are you going to go through this? I think you are, aren't you? I'm not sure where I'm spending time, and I'm running a bit behind. Let me pass over this argument. This is a very simple argument for the equivalence rule, and it depends on symmetry. It's a symmetry argument, and it's saying with equally weighted outcomes, you can really preference. Well, I am going through it, aren't I? Sorry, you will go through it. Well, look, because I'm running a bit late. Let me leave it to David to explain. It's a beautifully simple argument. It doesn't take long, but let me just pass it over. And what this tells us is the equivalence principle doesn't really have to stand alone as an independent premise. Really, one has this structure to the argument, and that's very remarkable. There's a further thing to say, well, I've already said it, sorry, that of course, if chance is intelligible in the face of branching, then you just go the standard routes anyway, as goes empirical confirmation of the theory. So these two things are not in disagreement with one another. They will be in disagreement with one another if you're on an anomalous branch. Okay? If you happen to be very, 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 very unlucky, then going this route, you'll get something and you'll arrive at weights which actually won't be the right weights. So you'll be your subjective degrees of belief will be tuned to something that actually isn't the real ontology. And you'll just be unfortunate. You know, normal empirical methodology just failed through bad luck. But that can happen in a dynamical state reduction theory as well, given sufficient amount of length of time it's bound to. Okay. So the situation there isn't really so different, that's the thing. All right, now, but what happens if, no, it's not coherent to think about branching as uncertainty? What if that isn't right? And now we've taken out a rather central foundation for the whole thing. Everything falls apart. The whole thing falls apart. David, I don't know why you're smiling. You want it to fall apart. Of course, which David am I talking to? There's rather many in this room. But here's the way to go if uncertainty is unintelligible. Okay, and this is the method. Uncertainty, okay, one doesn't have it, but one has this Kering measure, and there's a route to solving the epistemic problem, and given which you've got the ontology, and anyway you've got the practical problem solved. So what is this? Equally, may I say, one might, on the basis of this successful conclusion, come back to this issue and say, well, you know, it's not such an unreasonable thing to think after all. It's just rather one way. It's not compelling enough to go this way, but it's okay to go this way. And the arguments from ordinary language usage and so forth might be reasonable enough for that. Okay, so how does this work? Well, it goes somewhat similarly to before. Introduce axioms of rationality as before, to be satisfied, blah, blah, blah. But now, and doing the same thing here. Okay, you've got the same sort of representation theorem, but now here's the difference, or a further piece to the jigsaw. You show that implicit in that probability distribution of that rational actor, call it degree of care, I shouldn't call it probability, call it degree of care. She acts as if employing standard Bayesian updating on priors. But that's the key point. You've got the standard Bayesian epistemology in place. You don't need a special epistemic principle, a special epistemic rule. Okay? That's the key point. Well, and the further key point, it applies whether or not you've got branching. You can be neutral about it, as you should if you're a Bayesian. Don't assign zero priors to anything, okay? And if you do that and you don't assign zero priors to anything, then you will be led to confirm, I'm sorry, those that you don't like it, too bad, you will be led to confirm Everettian quantum mechanics as long as you ascribe to these actions of decision theory. And these actions of decision theory are very persuasive. They are extremely compelling. So I'm sorry to say, I mean, I wish Anthony Valentini were here, you know, pilot wave theorist, or, you know, various other people. You will confirm Everettian quantum theory, like it or not. It's also a rather remarkable result.
Does this mean that the caring measure, you must be assuming that it can be employed to the proposition that the branching universe is the actual one, and also to the proposition that the non-branching universe is the actual one?
Yes, indeed. The caring measure would be available. No, not at all. The caring measure is exactly the thing available to a metaphysician who thinks in the face of four dimensions and there's no such thing as change. You know, they know you're stuck, you're a brain at an event, at an instant, that's it. There is no change, you know, but you can still sort of survey these
possible, you know, these different, one can bring free will into the issue here, but let's not do that. So you've got choices as to how to negotiate, you know, this four-dimensional non-branching universe using your caring measure. You've still got to assign different degrees of care to what you want there to be downstream. It's not going to be you, there is no change, there is no, you know, and so on and so forth. Okay, now, the other thing is, of course, there's the possibility, is the caring measure good enough to drive this argument? Okay, in other words, does this issue that branches are chances, is it essential to the argument that gave us from given the ontology to... And that's an interesting question, too. And that would be a fantastic result if so, because then one really is on absolutely minimal premises doing this extraordinary thing that hasn't been done before by any physical theory when it comes to probability. And I think that view has been defended, but I'm not sure if the person defending it still defends it. And I don't know quite who else defends it. So I don't know about that. All right, now, I'm in the home stretch. I'm pretty well done with issues of probability. But I want to say something about ontology. Hitherto, we've been supposing the problem solved of ontology, modulo what to say about personal fission. But now I want to raise some questions. Let's go back to the ontology question, and let's look at some incoherence problems. Because I'm overviewing things that are going to be much talked about later, forgive me if I have a rather smaller question period than normal. I mean, normally, I think question periods are absolutely tremendously important and everything, but in introducing stuff that's going to be much debated, it can become a bit silly because one says to somebody, well, what do you say about this? And they say, well, my thoughts about that. So if I can crave indulgence and perhaps go a little bit over time. Thank you. So what's the wave function of, you know, well, you might say, well, look, it's like an electromagnetic field on three-dimensional space, you know, it doesn't have to be a function of anything, it's just a field. Okay, but then in that case, well, does that mean configuration space is real? I mean, is one committed to that? And remember the background, you know, context in which we're working, you know, universe, no special interpretative assumptions, you know, or additional anything. Yes.
Excuse me, I won't try to answer that right now, because I'm a bit short of time.
Space
room. Yes. Yeah. Is it
real in the way that space is real? Yeah.
Space is supposed to be a one trajectory. Space time is supposed to be one trajectory in the configuration space.
No, I'm not. I mean, the comparison has been a different theory, just the classical electromagnetism. Do we have a problem with saying that you've just got a function on space? Is that a problem? Is the ontology? No, we think not. Classical electromagnetism, we're fine. We think we've got a problem with that. So the issue is, well, see, that's going to be the line. You don't have to have it being a function of anything. It's just a function on the space. Well, then fine. If that's the case, then there's an integration space. All right. Now, I want to address that, but I want to do it going around the root of the quantitative problem, because the quantitative problem brings in a battery of formal techniques that everybody is familiar with, and we know how to put them to work. And then I want to come back to the incoherence problem. So the quantitative problem, of course, is answered by decoherence theory. And we'll be learning more about how that goes. Jim Hartle is going to give us a talk. He's great, one of the founding fathers of the subject. Now,
Just briefly, how it goes, you've got, actually, I don't really want phase space here, I want configuration space. You can sort of do it in phase space, but you don't have projections and stuff. You define Heisenberg picture operators in the standard way, and then define a history as a sequence of such projections. Okay, and putting Everett to one side now, just looking at the decoherence literature, where people help themselves to the concept of probability without further ado, they're not particularly talking about a realist interpretation, they're not talking about Everett, they're just doing, as it were, problem-solving in the way of mathematical equations, trying to do whatever. Okay, so this is the way they talk. Absolute probability is given by this quantity here, and you can define conditional or relative probabilities in the obvious way. And consistency conditions arise if you are going to interpret these things as probabilities. So is it the case that probability go from alpha k to alpha I is the sum over these intermediate states, configurations, is it that sum or not? Well, it is satisfied if these things are approximately orthogonal. And a simple example where they're not, and it's clear the consistency condition is violated, is if you're looking at projectors onto positions, just be a one particle case, it's just position in space. And then the probability to go from here to here just isn't the sum of the probability to go from here through here to here and so forth. And that's just totally familiar and obvious. Okay. So consistent or decoherent history space requires a choice of projectors at each time, summing to unity, so-called resolution of the identity, satisfying the condition, the consistency conditions. And you've got all possible sequences. You can construct histories out of these in all possible ways. And assign them probabilities and so forth. Now, quasi-classical domain, a consistent history space and a state sharply peaked on histories obeying approximately classical deterministic equations. Okay, fine. Now, I was going to go through the Feynman-Verneuil dissipation function, give you a bit of an example of this. This is a function now which actually, that may not look it, but that's what this thing is. If you had going from the point so Q final, Q F primed. But if you coarse grain, which is what you have to do to get decoherence, then you get this integral instead. You stick this thing in here. Various sorts of manipulations follow. This thing is the crucial bit. This is integrating out the fast degrees of freedom, looking just at the slow ones. This thing with the sine and so forth. You've got an I hitting it, so you get a negative term in the exponential, and it dampens down very sharply for these things being much different from one another. Okay, and this is the basis of, well, you get decoherence timescales and so forth, which are always phenomenally short. And this has been analyzed in various models, Yaus and Zay, Zurich, Wojciech here. Again, a privilege to have somebody who did this work to talk. I don't know if they're talking about your model, but anyway. Also, hydrodynamical variables which don't involve integrating out fast variables and slow. The fast-slow distinction is one that's fairly normal in the literature. Let me not go through it. Okay, so that's decoherence theory. It gives you the branching structure. It gives it to you as an approximately defined branching structure. It's fuzzy. You can't get something perfectly sharp and precise. But why would you think you would? Okay, why?
Get a branching structure.
Sure. What variables decohere?
There's a lot to say about this. I'm not going to go into the exact, but I'm just trying to focus on some general features of decoherence as giving you a branching structure. It's fuzzy, but then really the name of the game here is classicality is high-level ontology. Let me use that phrase, fancy phrase that philosophers use a lot. High-level ontology. Ontology, stuff, things that arise in a special science. You know, so meteorologists study hurricanes. Would you axiomatize a hurricane? Okay, a hurricane is going to be a fuzzy thing. It's not going to be something that obeys precise equations. It's not going to be something that's got its own distinctive foundational analysis. It's going to be something that is based and grounded on some lower-level theory. Which in turn, and then there's a tower. You've got a tower of theories, and that's just standard. And the claim is, and this is, I think, central to the Everett interpretation, that quasi-classicality is like that. Quasi-classical phenomena is this imprecisely define high-level ontology, grounded on the fundamental thing. But what is the fundamental thing? That's the issue now. And what I want to say here, well, go back to what I started with. Instead, let me talk about canonical coordinates. So I'm going back to the, apologies, I'm going back to the structure of Hamiltonian mechanics here. Don't talk about probabilities, talk about correlations. Okay, and in fact, that's just what Everett originally did. I mean, this stuff, this relative state, is exactly, one can define it in terms of a relationship of value definiteness, that, you know, alpha k is value definite relative to alpha j, so correlated with, perfectly correlated with, if this thing is one. So one has a system of correlations. Okay, and this relation actually is transitive for space-like projectors and consistent time-like ones, so there's certain formal characteristics of this relation, the structure of correlations that one can build up. But the claim is going to be that what one has fundamentally is all correlations among all patterns of particles in a particle theory. Okay, thank you. And more generally, all correlations among patterns on polarizations of an n-particle phase space. And this is how you quantize. It's a geometric quantization program where you take a polarization of phase space. And you can do it in various different ways. And these momentum space, position space are examples of that. So I was just looking at all patterns, all correlations. And probability is just nowhere here. There is no probability at this level. Okay. But that's the fundamental level. That's the claim. And the further claim is that, well, and this is what decoherence does. Only some of those correlations among patterns are stable under perturbations, coarse grainings and so forth, yielding dynamically decoupled branching histories, all that stuff. Only some of these patterns, typically coarse grainings of those patterns, are finally what the decoherence theory is giving us, quasi-classicality. Right? And you can do the same in a field theory. All correlations among field configurations, again referred to polarizations on phase space, exist. Okay. And the claim is further, this is after all what happens in every other physical theory that we know of. In classical general relativity, you've got all correlations among values of fields on the manifolds. All of those correlations exist. Specifically, diffeomorphic invariant relations exist. Those are the things that are real. But only some of them are stable under perturbations, yielding dynamically decoupled but non-branching histories. What's this? The Everett interpretation of general relativity? Yes. Exactly, the Everett interpretation of general relativity, and here they are. They're things like galaxies, stars, and planets. And another comment, their patterns of values of fields can be referred to any foliation, but some foliations are more perspicuous than others, and so forth. So one's seeing very similar strategies in other physical theories. Okay. The key issue, though, and this is addressed to a certain minor audience that, it's not a minor audience at all, but there are those who think, look, if I've got a history space, I've got a set of histories, why not just say one of them is real? And I think you see the need. You'd better have all data on all leaves of the foliation here. The idea that you take data just on one leaf with one foliation, data on another leaf with another foliation, and this would just give you chaos and nonsense. Right, so conclusion, summary, I've said what I have to say about ontology, just to summarize on the probability side. Here's one way of doing it, for those who see no sense to the notion of uncertainty in the face of division, of fission. And here's the other way of doing it. And either way, actually, you get to solve the relevant problems. So I think that's it. Thank you.
We've got just under 15 minutes, Professor, so I think you'll have to
do half the test. Human decision theory, right, sounds like a sort of rather fuzzy subject on which one might expect different human beings to agree and disagree on the decision. So, and I presume when we're talking about probabilities, right, assigning probabilities, if we're talking about probabilities, assigning probabilities to data we have, right, have in the near future, not to some abstract, idealized situations. So what is it that explains the precision of the result?
right, that you get Born's rule with two, right, say alcohol, infinite number of zeros, and not two to 0.6.
Well, I don't think we do get problems with that sort of accuracy, actually. Anyway, so that's...
So you said it converged on Born's rule.
Sorry?
You said the result was Born's rule.
Yes.
A little family of rules corresponding to the
answer. Let me just go back. Now, the thing is, on this route, you suppose you have the ontology. Okay, so you suppose you know the weights, precisely. Okay, and when those weights are precisely, there's an argument, a rationality argument, or sort of quasi-rationality argument, that says you'd better assign equal subjective to these weights. And if you do that, then mathematically you can use with the same precision that you assign degree to the weight in all the other cases too. Now, as to the axioms, whether the axioms are somehow vague or open to disagreement, and so on and so forth, I don't know what's right. If you actually look at the axioms relevant on this route, they're to Wallace, there's three of them, was there four? I mean, they're extraordinary. I don't think anybody
would disagree with them.
I think that's just not a debate. These axioms Well, that's the question. Oh, well, great. I'll hand over to David on that one. Okay, can I just make a comment about your question? Now, if you're going the other route, and of course you've got to go the other route to some extent, even if this argument is right, but how do you get to the weights? How do you get to the weights? Well, you go to normal experimental practice, and through normal experimental practice, you get to write down for a given apparatus the state you think it's preparing, but only to some accuracy.
Yeah.
Right.
I guess I'll have to ask later. Thank you.
So, two comments. One is closely related to that. That I think that the argument about Bayesian updating and subjective probabilities almost a red herring, because all the data which we're discussing, which lead us to perform probabilities, are simple counts of past outcomes over categories of what we think are fairly narrow defined experiments. So, the other stuff seems like sort of a generic probability argument that really doesn't have much to do with this particular issue of why one probabilities. And then, on the question of are the Deutsch-Wallace assumptions inevitably compelling to any rational person? Maybe this is rationality, but there's one assumption which is substitutivity. That is that.
No. There's a bit of a problem here, which is there's about 10 different versions of this argument now. And it's very unfortunate. Well, it's unfortunate, but it just does lead to people, they get one and they get another. The one I'm talking about is the time of time. It's in the Tony Archive, I think, in fact. It's appearing in this year's Studies in Christian Cosmic Physics and Non-Physics. This argument is the one that goes from equivalent to ordinal. And that argument, the decision theory axioms, are extraordinarily weak. They're nothing like the ones that are in Deutsch's paper in 99.
I'm thinking of Wallace's paper.
Which one?
It's a fairly long one.
The very long one, 2003, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about much weaker action. So but we will see these actions, so let's not discuss this right now. But the one point that I want to make in answer to your issue is that, look, it's just that empirical methodology is normal. You just look at statistical evidence and it's just standard and all of these arguments are beside the point. I agree they're beside the point if chance makes sense. The issue is, what if chance doesn't make sense? And then you're in real uncharted waters, or it seems though you're in real uncharted waters, because it's very unique to do any sort of updating procedure to any sort of statistical inference, probabilistic inference, is in question, because you're not dealing with chance. You're dealing with something else, call it squiggledy. If squiggledy is this, then you're supposed to update your credence. Why? So you need a special epistemic rule, a special updating rule. Why think that? Why believe in that rule? And so on. So that's why these things matter. That's why it's very important to go this route to find a weak enough set of axioms to get this representation theorem in place, which tells you you are updating in the standard way. And once you've got that, then you've got a case. Whether or not you've got branching, whether or not there's any uncertainty in the case of branching, still you can arrive at confirmation for the theory, neutral between whether there's branching or not.
He's
there. Yeah, Simon, I'm confused about what your arguments have to do with realism. So there's always been another reading of Everett, which is a contingent or a kind of deductivist or if-thenist reading of Everett, in which the correlations are to be read of. If you see a certain number of things, you can predict other things than the correlations. And so it's at some crucial point toward the end of your argument, you said, all the correlations exist in the sense of the space-time correlations, but do I need to read that as a realist, or can I read that as the theory predicts in a deductivist or a contingent sense, all the correlations are predictions of theory, without being a realist about it?
I do find the question a bit baffling, to be honest. Let me try to say something.
It's not surprising because I'm baffled.
I'm not familiar with this reading level. I didn't think Everett was ever of interest to anybody. He wasn't here. Why not convey something with man in many worlds?
The word many worlds is not in Everett's original paper.
Oh, but it's totally in his thesis, and it fits with his thesis.
And his paper is different reading. I mean, if you read carefully his thesis, it's much less committal, relative state and real love. And it's only, I think, this footnote that you may want to look at, which kind of nails many words.
I've already displayed my awful and falling scholarship. But only 2 nights ago, I was reading a chapter from his thesis that I think was excised on rules and systems. But it's absolutely clear about this.
I haven't read the excised paper. Well, but I don't know on what systems they were excised.
Well, Max sent it to me. Thank you very much, Max. I think
great.
Before, I think this is a bit sterile anyway, because that's what we care. But now the issue of the structure of correlations, yes, I think Eric did present the general picture is one in which you've got a structure of correlations rather than a plurality of worlds. What I'm saying is the fundamental ontology is nothing but structures of correlations. It's kind of structural, totally comprehensible as it is. I mean, how on earth are you going to make sense of it? Deacon Hinsley is exactly a battery of tools to try from this enormously structured thing, but one that isn't recognizable, to try to extract some recognizable structure. And the recognizable structure is the robust structure. It's the stuff that is. And then there's a lot to say about the virtues of the classicality as extracted through, say, centers of mass variables, weakly coupled with lots of lighter particles, why mass is important, and so on and so forth. So there's a great deal to say about that. But Lee, I don't think that's your question. You're not asking a question about the classicality of people.
Let me try to rephrase it. If you started out wanting to be a realist about quantum mechanics, after these recent developments, I have the impression you're much happier. Someone is much happier, and I appreciate that. But one might, after all, the intention of the Everett interpretation was to extend quantum mechanics from the theory of small subsystems of the universe to be able to discuss the universe as a whole.
Sure.
Since you mentioned the analogy to configuration space, there is an issue of existence or realism about configuration space when applied to the universe as a whole, because what is the status?
Sure.
Do the configurations which are actually realized in the universe have a different status than the configurations that are never realized?
Right.
And so one can choose not to be a realist about configuration space when applied to cosmology, and one can choose not to be a realist about Hilbert space as applied to quantum mechanics. And I think read the relative state interpretation and decoherence theory as an advice within a non-realist
Good. So I think this is true. That among people who work on decoherence theory, there are many non-realists. Or at least there are people who aren't bothered about which is a realism. And there are some explicit non-realists. Those people may have assistance for you in quantum cosmology questions, where perhaps you don't have a well-defined theory at all. Your point about you want to give up on configuration space or something in quantum cosmology, I'm not particularly bothered about configuration space. What I'm looking at is the generality that one has in non-relativistic and special relativistic theories, where you've got something like most of the symplectic group taking members of the unitary group, and you have that sort of generality. And I'm not privileging one representation over another at the fundamental level. Whatever privileging goes on in terms of what is emergent structure. So what I hear you saying is, look, we don't have a well-defined open space in quantum cosmology. We don't have the wherewithal to execute this program. Okay, that may be true. But I'm sorry, I defer to experts as to what is the present state of play. Right. I don't think it's very germane to understanding the story, the non-relativistic and special relativistic.
Simon, you want to take away the side of the ontologies.
Yes.
Can you help me understand what that means?
Amplitude squared?
That's a number, but yes. The number is not part of the ontology.
Yes, I think it is. The fundamental ontology is this highly structural set of correlations among patterns, particles in the particle theory, or patterns in the field configurations. Those correlations, that correlated structure, that's what I'm taking to be a fundamental ontology.
And how do the weights figure into that correlated structure?
They don't, not yet. It's only once you've got a branching structure when you've got causally autonomous causal decoupling of bits of the pattern. Then, and insofar as those things give you weights of branching which involve you, then I would say you've got full-blooded probability. Now, failing that, it's not clear that you've got something that you should couldn't probability
one
at all.
Couldn't the same branching structure between the weights?
No.
And why not?
The branching structure is defined in terms of these correlations. They're what give you structure. There's no structure without them.
So the fuzziness is still there once you specify the weights.
The fuzziness?
Yes, the branching structure.
The fuzziness, but what you're doing is you're picking up patterns. Okay, and those patterns are fuzzy.
Right.
Now, so if you ask precise questions, you won't get precise answers.
Sure.
And if you ask precisely what is the weight of this fuzzy thing, you're not going to get an answer to that either. So yeah, what the weight is, because it's a fuzzy thing that we're looking at, what the weight is also going to be fuzzy. It's just like temperature. Think of temperature.
Fuzziness is not a problem. It's the ontology of the weights that I'm worried about.
The ontology? I don't see why that is a worry. If you accept the fundamental ontology as the structure of set of correlations, okay. Look, here's something Dirac said made in his life. When I first started quantum mechanics, I thought not commutativity. But I've come in the course of my life, I suppose, to see that no, it's these transition amplitudes. Those are the things. And I think he's right. I think quantum mechanics is fundamentally the discovery that it's entirely new category of relationship. Not spatial relation, not temporal relation, not spatial-temporal relation. This new sort of relation, these amplitudes. Some of which are rightly viewed as probabilities.
Okay,
yeah.
Thinking.
My question
is, okay, well, because it's more of the end of the day, so we've set aside again.